Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yu Yunzhen, host of our monthly podcast, Zhonghua Mundus, that brings you recent updates about China's economy. As usual, I am joined by our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hi, Alicia. How's it going?
All fine. Thank you, Yu Yun.
We are also glad to have with us today Romana Vlahutin, a visiting distinguished fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Previously, she served as Ambassador-at-Large, EU Special Envoy for Connectivity in the European External Action Service. Hi, Romana. Welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Hi, and thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you both here. Today, we are taking a deep dive into the Global Gateway, the European Union's ambitious initiative to boost global infrastructure development and connectivity. Announced in 2021, it aims to mobilize up to 300 billion euros by 2027 across key sectors. In 2023, 9 projects were launched worldwide across the digital, energy, and transport sectors through this initiative to strengthen health, education, and research systems globally. Romana, could you give us a stock take of the Global Gateway Initiative, please?
Yes, maybe if you allow me, just a little bit of historical perspective so that our audience understands where this all started from. Sometime in 2017, 2018, it became clear to Europe that China is doing something that is fundamentally changing the structure of relations in the world. That is creating dependencies, in particular in the global south, that will have different type of consequences from global governance to economics. And it coincided with another understanding that then president of the Commission, Juncker, he used the phrase, European Union is a payer, but not a player. So understanding that European Union is giving the largest amount of ODA and support for developing and emerging economies, but somehow that massive investment has little output, not only for the countries where investments are made, but also for European political and security interests. And something had to change. So in 2018, European Union came up with the so-called EU-Asia strategy. And I came to the file in early 2019. And already then it was clear that the EU-Asia strategy was just too limited. It very clearly said this is a strategy based on our belief that we are a normative leader and this is how we will change the rules of connectivity, but said very bluntly there is no money for this, which I think is non-starter for a connectivity strategy as it is. And the second element was if EU wanted to be a global player, it made absolutely no sense to have only Asia strategy. So already from 2019, we started working on the global European connectivity strategy. In 2021, the first output is what is now known as a global gateway.
Thank you very much for that historical input. I think it's very important for our audience to know, like from a historical perspective, where the project starts and then how it came into effect. Since last year, the projects have really started taking off. Could you give us a perspective on how it's going?
When it comes to the projects of the Global Gateway, I think it's actually the best picture of the confusion. There are around 225 flagships, which in itself, I think, is a sign of a problem because it basically means all projects that are included and it doesn't show any priority among them. You have sort of three groups in these 225 flagships. You have a very sort of general phrasing group where the flagship project is increasing investment in connectivity, for example, in Laos, or call for proposals or feasibility studies, etc. So the prep work, which by definition is not a flagship project. Project is something that is tangible and already defined. Then you have the second group, which is, I would say, the usual development projects. You have water and waste management, improvement to local traffic, upgrades in parts of infrastructure, etc. There are two key questions here. First, in terms of business involvement, who do they really benefit? Do they benefit the local manufacturing, and how? Do they benefit European businesses who can then invest, or European investors? This is very tricky because the European aid philosophy is strictly non-tied. So I really don't know how, in the procurement procedure, European Union can make sure that for all these projects, it's actually the European private sector that can benefit, or European private sector and local companies, or local companies, but really then authentic local companies. And then who are they going to benefit sort of in the final use in a way? Is it really a benefit to, let's say, Africa, Europe value chains? Or it's a benefit for Africa-China value chains? Because unfortunately, in the experience so far, this is what has been the case. In the end, China benefited the most. And the third one is the group of projects in the neighborhood, be it East, Western Balkans, or the Mediterranean. They make most sense. You can see a clear value chain that links these parts with Europe. It's mostly energy, and it also talks to the, you know, renewed north-south connectivity. The only problem is they have all been thought of before and within a completely different parts of commission. Not DG INPA, which is in charge of the Global Gateway, but the part of the commission that worked on the neighborhood and will now be in two different DGs, which is DG Mediterranean and DG Enlargement. So it is really kind of hard to understand what is the big picture, what is the strategic thinking behind it. How is European Union going to ensure that this investment benefits not only sort of the local value chains or the local communities, which goes under the definition of development assistance, but strategic investment that also benefits European Union. And I think when you just look at a list of all these so-called flagships, you understand that something needs to change in the approach.
Earlier this year, there was a forum that started where Ursula von der Leyen invited many leaders from Africa countries and as well as business leaders in order to boost up the infrastructure. Was there any fruitful result coming out of it?
It is really, so the main sort of focus of Global Gateway for the time being is Africa. And the main I think problem of Global Gateway is that I'm not sure there is a clarity on what the task is. There are at least 5, 6, 7 definitions of what Global Gateway is from the institutions. So they go from UN agenda of SDGs to being a pillar of economic security, alternative offer to BRI, a geopolitical effort, exports or European foreign econ offer, export promotion, whatever. So that is very confusing, not only on the European side, but also on the side of our partners in different parts of the world. The asking of developing and emerging economies is quite clear. They want to move up the value chain. How Global Gateway is responding to that is not clear. This is a key issue because the fundamental problem there is by being placed in DG INTPA and just being dealt with as within this development framework, it's seen as something that is a continuation or a better way of doing development. But investment in value chains is a strategic investment. It really needs a different kind of take. And there is a mixture between instruments and the policy. And I think this is confusing for everyone. And that would be a task number one, I think, of the new commissioner, to make it really clear what are we talking about, and to sort of then reshape the initiative so that it can deliver on its main, or what should be its main task. And that's really diversification and reconfiguring of value chains between Europe and the rest of the world.
Thank you, Romana. I hear your concerns on what the project is actually about and then what should be the priority focus from that. And now shifting our gears a bit to the geopolitical dimension, you also mentioned that this is a direct inspiration from the EU finding out that China is having a different global strategy and that's going to very much change the world in a very drastic way. And the Global Gateway is Europe's attempt to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative. Alicia, that's when I want you to come in here. And could you give us a comparison between the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, and Global Gateway? What is similar and what is different in these projects and what their scopes and influences are?
Thank you, Yin, and thanks, Romana, because it is really good that you really give us this input about Global Gateway is about, because I can only tell you so many people don't know what it is about. And that's already very helpful that firstly, we don't have a clear view yet, and I think we should. But let me also tell you that for a project as important as the Belt and Road Initiative, for years and years, most people didn't really know what it was about. And I have to tell you, even now, I think as of now, what the BRI was about in 2015 is certainly not what it is about today. So in a way, one important issue is that I guess, you know, it evolves. Yeah. And the question is it the right direction? Or, well, the Belt and Road Initiative, I think it started with a need. China had a need. The need was really very simple. Overcapacity. We're back to overcapacity 2015. The project was launched in 13, but it was mostly like one of the very many like narratives. Nothing happened for 2 years. Everybody talked about it. But in 15, when China entered this massive, frankly, stock market correction, deflation, huge overcapacity in certain sectors, I think basically there was this idea, okay, let's push for this. Let's get our companies out to reduce overcapacity. And they started with six corridors. I mean, they're well known, but basically it had a geographical structure. It was mostly about exporting your way out. And especially in infrastructure, a sector that was in massive overcapacity in China because it had grown enormously after the Olympics and China's response to the global financial crisis, which is a massive stimulus, mostly in infrastructure and real estate. China's companies in these two sectors were humongous, and they just couldn't operate, you know, only even the shipping companies, you know, all of these things were too big for China. So they went overseas through the BRI. They knew that this was already a time where Obama was a little bit like pivot east, too much of China, you know, the containment, in a way, or if you want, was starting already. Yeah, I mean, the U.S. had already turned, and all the more so with the first Trump administration. So for China, going west, i.e. going to the U.S., was not possible. Going to Europe, maybe, but, you know, Europe had its own big infrastructure companies, etc. So the best way was the Global South, which, frankly, we didn't even call Global South then. But and that's the BRI. So it started as an overcapacity escape, call it this way. And it became, because it was in a way designed in a way that it created routes, going back to Romana's point of connectivity, routes that would make it easier for China to have
strong trade and investment connections with these countries. That it was all designed as a hub and spoke. Everything goes back to China in a way. And that's what it was. And I end here because I don't know whether our global gateway ever will transform itself as the BRI has transformed itself for China. Now it's really more of a political reality. I would say sometimes even security, veiled security, if you want, reality. I mean, it has still an economic front line, but it is not only, and this is very different from the Global Gateway, it's certainly not only an economic proposition. Now, is it better because of that? Do people, do countries want something else? Well, given the state of the world with Trump, this creates an alternative. And I think this is why the Global South has found this offer more appealing rather than less appealing, which is ironic, but it's because the other alternative, like ever-existing option of the US, is becoming very dangerous and very, very uncertain. Maybe it's uncertain. I don't know whether dangerous yet, maybe, but we don't know yet. So that's the point. That evolution, I want to highlight that evolution. In the Global Gateway, we don't even know the direction yet, but certainly we can't really guess the evolution because we're at the beginning of this.
Yes, indeed. And have you heard discussions or conversations about how China views the Global Gateway initiative?
Yuyun, the good thing about being very long with the question is that I can be very short with this one. Nobody talks about the Global Gateway in China, and I leave it there.
Okay, you're coinciding with Romana's earlier assessment that people are still very confused about Global Gateway, its impact is not there yet. So Romana, as you already pointed out, there is so many confusion with the project. And what do you think went wrong with it? Like, was it the starting point of mixing development and investment?
I think the problem, so on the top political level, there was an understanding that we have to get return on our investment in different ways, in economic, in political, in security sense. And just, I think it's important for our listeners to know, when you look at numbers annually and cumulatively, European Union area, which means European institutions and member states, give basically the same amount of money through its ODA as China disburses through the loans through the BRI. So we are talking exactly about, I mean, almost the same amount of money, which is working for China and is not working for the EU. And the question is why. So when this political understanding was trickled down to the institutional level, unfortunately, I think the institutional thinking took over, and there is this logic, if something is happening in the developing world, then it's development policy, and these are the only instruments that we have. So this confusion starts from really, I think, not understanding the task. And it is keeping, it's keeping this strategy or this idea that European Union very much needs. It's keeping it from being developed and has its consequences. So I see three elements there which are essential. The first one is, you know, the strategy itself. I think this needs to be clarified. And really, Global Gateway or whatever they might call it has to be understood as a strategic commercial investment in value chains where both European Union and its partners have very clear interests. The problem with our development assistance, or the fact about our development assistance, is it's non-tied aid. And the logic of it starts somewhere completely different. And I don't think it can be, it can be changed in a way that, you know, the reality fits our instruments. Our instruments have to fit our reality, and this is a problem. So there is issue of strategy. There is also issue of scale. Global Gateway talks about up to 300 billion. And that means there is a hope that each, you know, million of guarantees would raise 5 million of investments, but that's not a given. And there are very different experiences from ratio 1-to-1 or 1-to-2 in difficult circumstances to maybe 1-to-5 in European type of environments. So it's also even 300 billion, if there was that money in real terms, it would still not be enough. And at the same time, European Union is giving much more through its ODA and through its export credit support facilities in member states. And I think there will have to be done something about rebalancing that money, and it will have to be clear which amount is ODA and what everything else is to be put to work for the creation of these commercial opportunities again. Because you cannot reach the scale needed without private sector. Private sector has to be the center of this initiative. Unfortunately, at this moment, it's somewhere on the side. There is an advisory board, but I think it would be the best to leave it to the private sector and to partners in countries in the global south to sort of sit down and understand which pieces of industrial policies or respective industrial policies overlap and how we take it forward. And the third piece is speed. The BRI projects, from signing the deal to or identifying the project to finishing the project, they take around 1,000 days. Unfortunately, with the complexities of how these things are done institutionally in the European Union, only to get a feasibility study takes 1,000 days. And speed is really important. Speed is important for political reasons, because Chinese projects manage to be done within one election cycle, so it makes it very attractive for those who want to use it for political purposes. And also, they are visible. You can touch them, and this changes everything. European Union has been giving millions and millions in budget support. Nobody can see that, and with Chinese projects, you can they make the quality of your life, if you wish, a bit better, and people can identify with that. So I think there really needs to be a serious re-evaluation how this is done. And unfortunately, I don't believe that the institutional placement of the work on Global Gateway can produce success that we need, because there are other parts of the commission where this would make much more sense, from DG Grow to, just creating a standalone team that would put all the pieces of this together and propose, simplify and create a one-stop shop for projects for the Global Gateway.
You want to separate this issue from development to really make it more investment prioritizing. So how do you think the institutions can help mobilize private sector?
Private sector is not going to come into situations where it cannot make profit. And that's clear. So first of all, it's very hard to get especially bigger companies to invest in policy frameworks. They need to understand and be reassured that what they are investing in will have a return. And again, I think it would make it would be the best possible benefit for the project itself to be separated from sort of UN agenda on SDGs. It will be a result, partly, develop, if you invest in economic in development and industrialization of a certain country, if you create a manufacturing hub, if you help prompt the skills, etc., the good collateral will be development by default. But that's not the main goal. The main goal is, again, what our partners are asking us. And when you talk to anyone from the Global South, they will say, we don't want aid. We want investment. This is what will make them more competitive. This is what will make them more resilient. And this is what will make them grow economically. And I think it would do benefit both for our development agenda and for our strategic investment in value chains and, if you wish, de-risking and diversification agenda to have this clarity and also then to know clearly what amount of funding is available to support European private sector in their outreach, business outreach, and their investments in countries of the global South. Also, politically, I think it's not reasonable to say, you know, Africa is going to be our main priority. We have a situation where we really need to think what is in the best interest of Europe when it comes to different priorities. And we have to think about our neighborhood as well. I think everybody understands that Ukraine is going to be the main priority. And we have to let go, I think, of this European, it's not even an ambition. It's some sort of wishing to be everything to everyone at all times. That is not doable. And I think it's really important to have priorities, to have sort of geopolitical understanding of your priorities and to work to that aim. So again, strategy, scale, and speed are three key pieces where this needs to change.
Alicia, do you want to add an input here?
Yes, I think, first of all, it's very good that we say this loud and clear. And Roman and I were together in Delhi where we were told on our face, literally, we don't want your aid. And I thought, well, that's quite good because if you think about it, it is much easier or much more profitable, I mean, from the side of the lender to invest. And in that regard, I think, you know, we all should come to terms with this reality, although I actually don't even think it is true. But that's a different topic, okay? I mean, most of China's loans, certainly China Development Bank, which is considered, in terms of its own regulations, a commercial bank, is not giving any subsidized lending of any sort. So, you know, it seems if that's fine for China, why not fine for us? I mean, at the end of the day, I think we need to realize that if the countries are telling us they don't want any aid, if frankly aid for us is also not appealing, let's face it. I mean, if the investments are the right investments, it is certainly much better. So why are we not doing it?
Yeah, sorry to chime in here. Like, why do they not want aid?
I know, Yu-Yu. I know. Well, this is why I think it's quite... I mean, they keep on saying this, but I just wonder whether they really mean it. Because if I were a developing country, I would want some aid. Maybe I would want the right aid. I would want to utilize the aid. I would not want conditional aid. But I can't believe that European aid is more conditional than, you know, any other aid, whether it's US or China. So why don't they want aid? It's a good question. I mean, for me, it's quite surprising that there's this kind of reaction to aid. But at the end of the day, if this is this, maybe it's the government's, maybe, I don't know. If they don't want this aid because now there's an easier entry point from China, it's these are projects, as Romina said, that people see is a very maybe populist way to look at it, because many of these projects, for me, that may not necessarily make people better. Yeah, we have fast speed train in Eastern Africa where maybe we would need sanitation, you know, but fine. But at least people see the fast speed train. People see the improved airport. People see the football stadium. They might not see the sanitation that, you know, is out there. I don't know whether we do that, but the point is that maybe aid is less visible. You see, it's like, it kind of runs into the, I don't know, the back door of the Ministry of Finance, and nobody knows what is being paid with this aid. Yeah. While if you build a stadium, people see the stadium. So, and if you're a politician, you're quite happy with the stadium, you know. So, but just to make a long story short, I really want to make this point. The reason why we really can't compete, and Romana said it, but I want to highlight it, on the private sector side or in the investment side, I would say, is because China simply, and I've seen that, I mean, with my own eyes, comes up with a list. This was 2016. China Development Bank came up with a list of projects from NDRC, 400 projects, if I recall correctly, of things, of loans or projects that banks had to finance, and mostly Exim Bank and CDBs, China Development Bank. So, you know, in other words, the private sector in China goes where it is asked to go. We cannot do that with our companies. So there is like an implicit disadvantage, or maybe I would say explicit disadvantage, yeah, for this investment, is that in our case, unless we use, and this is a possibility, Romana, we kind of subsidize somehow. I mean, like, we use these funds, like kind of call it seed capital, you name it, for the private sector to move into projects that it wouldn't do otherwise, it wouldn't move otherwise. And it would still not be as powerful as telling my SOEs, my state-owned enterprises, go there and build a bridge or build. I mean, so it is very hard for us to compete because we are a market economy and we just can't do this. So how do we deal with this?
It's really interesting to look at numbers. And in these discussions, numbers are incredibly helpful. So I checked, double checked three times the amounts that three largest world economies, so US, China, and EU respectively, provide through what is the OECD definition of aid. The first global economy, US, they give annually around 60 billion. The second biggest economy, the Chinese one, gives annually 7 billion. And the third largest economy, European Union, annually gives around 9,500 billion. But the political and economic return on this is just very, very different. And where are we making a mistake? I was looking at how the Japanese are doing it. And when you look at the structure of their aid investment, 50% is infrastructure. For European Union, it was about 3-4%. What we do, we have these packages that are full with values that are front-loaded. And a lot of countries see this as outright patronizing. So we front load values and basically are allergic to any risk. And in situations where that developing countries are, I mean, if you're not willing to take a risk, it's not easy to really make much progress. So I think there has to be an understanding in European Union that, you know, you can bring sort of values and standards in different ways. And if you wish, strategic infrastructure is everything but value neutral. It has inherent values in it. And we need to listen to what people are telling us are their needs. I mean, just look at the demography. They have to create jobs, and they cannot create jobs without investments. That's not possible. And what Alicia said, when you look at what China is doing through the BRI, I mean, it's basically all loans. I think it's like 94% is loans that are quite expensive. The interest rate is anywhere between 4.5 to 6%. And then this drives countries into massive debts, etc. So we have to listen and try to understand why for the partner countries, it is far more important that we reorganize this in a way that what we provide is a strategic investment. A big chunk of it, I think, is also transfer of knowledge or, creating skills for the population. Again, demography is a huge factor in here. I think the median age in Africa is 18 years. In European Union is 43. So just think about that. And what is going to happen in terms of the labor force and the needs of that labor force in 10, 15 years' time? This is one of the big problems, I have to say, of European Union, that its horizon or its planning horizon is rather short. And you need to think, especially in today's incredibly quick world, of what is going to happen in 10, 15, 20 years. And finally, technology, the tech factor. The technology has, some qualities that can make it very useful for a serious sort of leap forward for developing economies. But it comes, first of all, with knowledge, and second, with infrastructure, primarily energy infrastructure. You cannot have advancement in modern technology without having very sturdy and plentiful energy infrastructure. And in the current situation, I mean, just recently we had COP meeting, it's clear that the solutions for more energy, clean energy, are not really there. And if developing countries do not catch up on this technological advancements, they will fall back even more than they are back now. So it's a mix. And I think what they get from China is sort of a straightforward investment, no too many questions. It happens quickly and it's visible. The fact that quality might not be the best, the fact that there might be too much debt, etc., might not be something that is the first thing on your mind when you want to win next elections. So I think we need to learn, we need to listen, and we need to change course. We need to do this in a much smarter way.
Alicia, I'll give the closing floor to you. What do you think the Global Gateway Initiative should look like?
Well, I have to say that I would partner. I want to say this upfront. I think we need, the EU is a big economic region. I know we lent a lot of money. I heard Romana saying like nearly 100 billion, much more compared to China. But the reality is that's eight, and China lends, and it has other channels of influence that we might not be able to use for obvious reasons. So because of that, I think we need, and yes, we may say, okay, our neighborhood, but what is left from our neighborhood? Like, we need powerful players. So I really like Romana's point on Japan. Okay, let's go with Japan. Let's go with South Korea. Why? Because if what we're doing is not working, why not learning from others who might be having, given their size, a bigger impact, and maybe we can kind of change, move from the idea of development to investment, because others are doing that, and we can just simply learn how to do it. Because it seems to me that we are still in this value driven kind of development agenda, and maybe we need to just move on and say, look, this is for our companies. This is a win-win, a very Chinese expression. But we maybe have to do this because I feel like time is of the essence here. So we need a little bit of an electroshock to And maybe if we keep working within the commission, IMPA, I'm sorry, I don't even know. I mean, I'm nobody to judge. But the point is, we need a change. You know, we need a big change. One way to do that is to just join forces. I just read a report on a proposal from the government of Australia to India for an infrastructure path up to 2030. I was shocked to see how detailed, so I'm thinking, okay, if Australia at the end of the day in the Indo-Pacific has a plan for India in the infrastructure, why don't we just jump on it and say, look, this would be a project that maybe Australian companies cannot deliver but what about if we join forces? So my last comment really is about, for once, let's remember, Europe used to be a large, have an impact that in a way could justify not finding alliances or partnerships. We're no longer there. We need to accept this and move on and find these partners and learn from others. And this is not only the US, because that would be very difficult at the current juncture. The US is retrenching from all of this, but there's many other countries out there. So for me, this would be a way to try different options, not only Global Gateway ourselves in our circle, talking about it, among each other without really anybody else knowing about this in the rest of the world.
May I add something for the end?
Yeah, of course.
I fully agree with Alicia, and I think there is already thinking that this platform of cooperation may be G7, because G7 is by far, when it comes to financial debt and capabilities, is by far the strongest bloc. But it's still suffering from this aid dimension, and I think we should lead on a change. And you mentioned electroshock. I think Trump will be a sort of electroshock by proxy. And it will be interesting. I mean, US has already started this by putting tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles, etc. It has already created some, I would say, positive disruptions that are pushing and forcing countries to change behaviors, including China. Could see that, and Indonesia has imposed 200% tariffs at a time. Turkey imposed tariffs. So this is going to change the dynamic, and it will make everything or decision-making on value chains, I think, much more intelligent, if you wish. But it will open additional opportunities for the EU, because I think many countries in the world, and Alicia also alluded to that, will be looking for safer space. And, space of China-US relationship will be too difficult to navigate. And there will be something just beneath that where a lot of also powerful economies will be. And I think looking for this safety in terms of investment is going to be an important opportunity for the EU if it's capable to seize the moment. I mean, I don't see it now, but we have to give a benefit of a doubt for the new commission, and maybe they will be able to overcome institutional thinking and really, employ the political and security thinking and do this in the right way.
Thank you very much, both. As you rightly mentioned, the Global Gateway is still on the starting, so maybe in a few months or in a few years, we'll come back and discuss again on this topic and see where it's going. I am Yun Zhan, and I am with Alicia Garcia Herrero from Bruegel and Romana Vlahutin from the German Marshall Fund of the United States. For listeners, you can find all our research on China at Bruegel.org and sign up for Zhonghua Mundus, our monthly China podcast and newsletter, with link in the show notes. Until next time, bye-bye.